Access number 28660, Captain Robert Bonner, Reel 8.
No.
We won't know the way around.
No.
How did the public respond? That's perhaps more to the point.
Well, we marched all the way down through literally cheering crowds through Piccadilly and Deansgate all the way to the town hall in Albert Square. The crowds all the way were absolutely fantastic, particularly in Piccadilly, where they were sort of 20, 30, 40 deep in places, and then marching down Market Street and Deansgate, where they were certainly 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 deep. Everybody in the area had come to say farewell to their own regiment. It was the most magnificent situation. Not only were all the families there, but all those, at that time, there were still many survivors of both world wars who turned out to see their old regiment march through the city. It was a great experience for all of us, and frankly one which is, you know, one would never forget at all.
Now, while you were at Chester, you weren't there long, about 6 weeks, but did you know you were going to Malaya, and what preparations were being made?
Yes, we knew we were going to Malaya by that stage. There had been a rather uncomfortable period earlier when, before we left Berlin, the decision was being made by higher authority somewhere as to whether Malaya or Korea was to be our final destination. Happily, as it turned out, our neighbours, the King's Regiment, the King's Liverpool Regiment in the neighbouring barracks in Berlin, were destined to go to Korea, and we went off to the rather more comfortable battle situation of Malaya.
What preparations were made while you were in Chester? You've got your national service draft, but was there anything else you were doing?
The main object of our life in Chester was to receive the recruits from the regular army and primarily of the national servicemen. National service intake really represented by the time we left England, a very large proportion of the strength of the battalion. At the same time, we had to teach all these young men how to carry out a certain amount of drill, because during the month that we were in England, we were going to exercise our freedom to march through the city of Manchester, colours flying, drums beating, and show the citizens of Manchester that they had a lively regiment that was still active.
Which we talked about last time. Now, so what happened next then, when you came to leave?
Well, the advance parties went off to Malaya quite quickly, after only a few weeks, to look at make all the preparatory arrangements in Malaya. And we sailed from Liverpool at the end of May to in the good ship Hallidale, which took us out to Singapore via Aden and Ceylon.
Hallidale,
Halladale.
Now, what were conditions like on the voyage?
Conditions were really very good. This was a seasoned troop ship, and it was remarkable, really, how quickly all of us, particularly the young 17, 18-year-old national servicemen, settled down into daily life on board. Because it was a long, slow voyage in comparison with the air trooping which they have nowadays, there was a lot of time which could have hung heavily on everybody's hands, but we had a very active and intensive training program, as best one could do on board a ship. But every day there was physical training, rifle shooting over the side of the ship, and lots of games and activities to try and keep everybody amused and content.
What were conditions like for you officers?
Conditions were a little more primitive than those which we were accustomed to in our splendid German barracks of previous years, but we were in small cabins, probably four of us to sharing a cabin, bunk beds, not a great deal of room, And of course, every morning, the ship's commandant and the commanding officer and the adjutant of the battalion and the military representative on board ship carried out captain's inspection. So for all of us, officers, non-commissioned officers alike, we had to ensure that after early breakfast, that everybody, in irrespective of officers in their little cabins or soldiers on the troop decks, had their hammocks rolled up and everything stowed away, just as important and as thorough an inspection as was carried out in barracks in the normal way.
What conditions like for the men in the troop decks? Were they good or bad? You know, they vary a lot on these troop ships.
Conditions, I suppose, were very basic. Not a great deal of room, but sufficient room to have available their kit bag and really very little else. So there wasn't a question of being able to put up pin-ups or anything like that. They had just a little amount of room and very little space to stow it. But all in all, it went very well, and food was very good. And although everybody was probably fairly sick going through the Bay of Biscay, by the time we had reached portside, people had acquired their sea legs and were only too delighted to to get on land and spend a few hours doing a bit of barting there.
What did you think of portside? Did you get ashore?
Yes, I got ashore. My only real memory of portside is that the party of us with our doctor, Ian McQuinney, were walking through the shopping centre, and of all people to experience this, the medical officer had his watch stolen from his wrist. So that's something which I'm sure he never forgot, and we certainly remember. But we were really quite glad to get away from there, because we didn't feel there was very much for the soldiers to see. We were much happier when eventually we got to Colombo in Ceylon, where we had a little more time and we were able to get off and really enjoy the pleasures of Ceylon for a short while.
Was it interesting, all these foreign places and cultures? I mean, you've been to Germany, but it's very different out there, isn't it?
It was very different, and I think by the time we had left Ceylon and on our last leg to Singapore, everybody was thoroughly fed up with the monotonous life of the troop ship, and really couldn't wait until we got to Singapore.
And what were your first impressions on arriving at Singapore?
Our first impression was, as we sailed into the big dock, to see our welcoming party of the commanding officer, Tommy Wolsey, and all those other officers and warrant officers and NCOs who had gone ahead in the advance party, waiting on the quayside to welcome us ashore. They came on board, and very quickly, the battalion was disembarked and onto the quayside and into waiting transport, 3-ton trucks, and we were quickly moved off through the outskirts of Singapore to our new barracks at Selarang, on the outskirts of Singapore.
Now, what was Selarang camp like at that point?
Selarang was a beautiful pre-war British Army barracks, built in the colonial style for everybody, soldiers and everybody else alike. There was plenty of space. The barrack rooms were large and airy, with automatic fans, and all very comfortable once everybody had settled in. In addition, of course, the soldiers had the facilities provided by the Indian what were they the
servant?
No, well, the Indian contractor. The Indian contractor to the battalion, who knew the Manchesters from Burma and pre-war, and recognized several of the senior officers from his experiences in those earlier days. And he provided the charwallas for every barrack room in the barracks. And very quickly, the soldiers grew to take advantage of these very interesting and helpful men who were constantly at their beck and call, 24 hours a day.
No, they were servants, basically.
Well, they weren't servants, I said, but they were exactly the sort of what one sort of Kipling-esque term thinks of as the charwallas providing tea and I suspect loans of money when required by the soldiery.
And did the contractors provide anything else?
At that stage, he in Singapore, I don't recollect him providing much more other than getting to know the soldiers, because he in fact came up country with us, and then of course their role with the battalion became much more important.
Come on, then. Now, when did you got there? Was it June? You set off in May. So.
Yeah, we arrived on. In the early hours of June the 28th.
And what happened? What are you doing at the Telerang Barracks?
Our primary purpose was jungle training and acclimatisation.
Well, which comes first? Would you acclimatise and then do the jungle training, or is it all part of
the same? All part of the same sequence. acclimatisation in that everything was... It was very warm and... everybody quickly, of course, had all changed into jungle green clothing, lightweight jungle green clothing, and Singapore, and certainly in and around Changi and Selarang, where our barracks were, large areas of jungle, secondary jungle and primary jungle, very similar, in fact, to that which we were going to experience when we went up country.
Tell me about the jungle training. Who took you through it, and what sort of things were you learning?
Jungle training was, put it another way, already some of the advance party had been to the Far East Jungle Training School, learning the techniques of operating in the jungle, and they were quickly involved as instructors to the majority of us in the battalion. Others who had newly arrived all went now to the jungle training center to learn the tricks themselves.
And what are the tricks? What do you have to learn? What did you learn?
Well, it was a completely different form of soldiering than that which we'd experienced in Europe. So the first things were, of course, learning to, as patrolling was going to be one of the most important aspects of our future role in Malaya, the significance of walking carefully and at good separate distances from the man in front of you through the jungle was probably the very first thing to learn. Then the question of stillness. The jungle is at times an extremely quiet place, and it was important that the soldiers learn to walk carefully and quietly without discarding anything which could be traced by a terrorist to indicate they've been there. And of course, smoking was discouraged, although I feel that in retrospect we didn't take a strong enough line on the question of allowing anybody to smoke, whether it be a pipe or a cigarette, because certainly looking back, the sort of the smell of cigarette smoke and British tobacco would have been easily traced by terrorists in the jungle. So, and also, of course, the question of, and the most important question, of keeping your eyes wide open at all times, because the jungle, we were walking or patrolling through very narrow paths, probably paths originally made by wild animals, with the jungle, of course, immediately on either side, the easiest place for people just to lie in wait in ambush.
Now, what about you? You were the mortar platoon. Was there a role in jungle warfare for mortars, or were you going to be acting as infantry? If you obviously you are, but you know what I mean.
Yes. I was fortunate, and I had a splendid 3-inch mortar platoon with all my non-commissioned officers, Sergeant Redwood and Sergeant Cameron and others who had been with us in Germany. So there was a nucleus of a very good team already there, and fortunately the national servicemen who had joined us in Chester very quickly were absorbed into this team, so it was a very happy band of soldiers, frankly, and I think that probably went for the other specialist platoons. But our role was really going to be a dual purpose, because although there would be occasions when we would be required to fire our mortars in anger, our main role would be as ordinary infantrymen patrolling as every other soldier in the rifle companies.
Now, anything else you were doing at Celeron?
We were having a splendid time socially.
Well, tell us about that. I mean, that's always, it's part of the army. Mm. What sort of social life did you have?
Certainly, our social life I won't say important, but certainly it was very interesting whilst we were in Singapore. And of course, officers, warrant officers, and NCOs alike all bought the standard white sharkskin dinner jackets, and we were fitted out by the contractor. One of his many jobs, of course, providing the tailors, but we were all fitted out with our white mess kits, which were worn with our standard blue trousers from patrol dress. So there were plenty of opportunities of wearing our new mess kits and also our white dinner jackets out and around the city.
Now, was it mess functions, or was it with a local European or Malayan population entertaining, or was it all those things?
Well, most of the social occasions were really based on the mess, because bear in mind we were only there for a relatively short time and not a great deal of opportunity of meeting and making new friends. So a lot of our social life was based on life in the officers' mess, and similarly for the warrant officers and sergeants in their mess. For the soldier, he didn't. The ordinary private soldier, of course, he didn't get involved in white mess kit, and but he had smart. Always had one set of smart jungle green uniform, and he would find plenty to amuse himself in Singapore, in the various Happy World complexes and downtown, in the varying eating establishments. So everybody really was, without being snobbish, was able to enjoy whatever type of social relaxation they wanted.
Now, how long were you there? Wasn't that long.
It wasn't that long, no.
June to
July, we left. Our stay in Singapore wasn't all that long, and on the 29th of July, we moved up country.
Now, where were you going? How much briefing and planning went into this?
Well, already the advance party had gone up to our new positions, and we were destined to go to the state of Kedah in the northwest of Malaya.
Can you spell that?
K-E-D-A-H. Already the heavy transport had gone up by road with escorts, and the bulk of the battalion had sailed on a landing ship tank called the Reginald Kerr. This was a metal vessel intended, as its name suggests, for the carrying of tanks and that sort of transport. But on this occasion, it was used for transporting the battalion. And it was a very uncomfortable and hot, unpleasant journey. It was entirely metal, and was not intended to carry large numbers of infantry. But we moved up the west coast of Malaya and got to a place called Prai, P-R-A-I, where we disembarked. I might add, I think, that fortunately we had the regimental band with us on board the Reginald Kerr, and so, God bless them, they were able to play from time to time to break up the monotony, and then, of course, they played us off the ship when we arrived at the port of disembarkation. And on arrival there, we were met by those of the advance party with the transport which had already arrived. And within a very short space of time, individual companies motored off to their different destinations, which were spread throughout the state of Kedah.
And where were you going as the support company?
Well, at this stage, I had a temporary change of appointment, and my mortar platoon was left in charge of the sergeants Redwood and Cameron, and I was made second in command of Charlie Company, which was going up to Crow on the Siamese border.
Crow spelled
K-R-O-H.
Seems obvious when you told
me. I know, indeed, yes.
Now, how did you get to Crow?
Well, Crow was a very fascinating place to go to. It was on top of a mountain, literally within 2 or 3 miles of the border with Siam or Thailand, and it was right in the heart of bandit country. The journey there from Prai, where we had landed, where we had disembarked, went through the flat countryside of the Kedah Plain, mostly devoted to agricultural purposes, and then after reaching the town of Baling, B-A-L-I-N-G, we hit the mountain track and then began what was a rather perilous journey up this winding mountain road to Crow, a small village isolated on top of this particular mountain. It had been the road had is a long road. I can't remember exactly how long it took us to go up and down it, but it was probably, I suppose, best part of an hour. Very slow progress, very steep inclines, jungle coming down to the road verges all the way, and it had been only a matter of short time earlier, the scene of a rather nasty ambush when our predecessors had suffered a large attack by the terrorists and suffered casualties.
Sir, were you on foot or in the lorry?
Oh, no, we were all in lorries. Lorries, yes. Yes, the journey, I suppose, the journey from where our point of disembarkation up to Crow would probably be best part of 3 hours, I suppose.
As you were in lorries, of course, you were extraordinarily vulnerable to being ambushed.
That's right.
There's nothing you can do to keep a lookout, really.
Well, everybody was on the lookout. And
but you can't exactly have people looking on the, you know, going ahead or checking.
No.
Maybe I've got this wrong. But
no, but every vehicle, we had scout cars, armoured scout cars with machine guns, probably leading the convoy. And then each vehicle, whether it was a 3-tonner or a 1,500 weight, would had a soldier with a Bren gun mounted on the bonnet, mounted on the canopy of the vehicle, searching the road ahead. And then indeed everybody, all the soldiers in the vehicle, looking out to their left and right, and again on the tailgate, another soldier with a Bren gun ready for the slightest incident.
So they may have been able to ambush you, but they'd have got a lot of firepower back.
They would indeed, yes, yes.
Now, nothing happened, I presume?
Nothing happened. I think, without knowing their intelligence skills, the local terrorists knew jolly well that there was a new battalion coming up, and it would not have been appropriate to have attacked at that time. So we arrived in Crow, which turned out to be a delightful little haven on top of this mountain, with a British resident, a district officer, a British district officer in his bungalow, a short distance away from the camp.
Could you just explain what his role was, and in fact how he managed to survive? He sounds a bit isolated.
Well, it was a very isolated position for a Briton in carrying out the role which the district officer had to employ. He had to look after the interests of the local community, whether they were Indian or Chinese or Malay, and was our really our liaison. I think put it another way, the community of Crow, really, it was a Malay village, a kampong, and there were Indians and Chinese who were looking after the local shops, and the British community consisted of the district officer John Day and his wife, and the British civilian police officer of the Malayan police, who was a man called Sam Small, SMAWL, who was what was described as the OCPD officer controlling police district. Now, between them, Sam Small and John Day ran the area of between Crow and Barling, the town down at the bottom of the hill, of the mountain. And it was a large area of responsibility, particularly, of course, having the neighbouring country of Siam right on their doorstep. But both John and Sam were delightful, efficient men. Both had their wives living with them in their bungalows, and of course both were protected at all times by the Malayan police.